Alabama's prison system has been in the news a lot this year, and not for good reasons. Inmate riots, allegations of mismanagement and corruption, and a failed prison building plan in the state legislature have pointed out plenty of problems. The Alabama Public Radio news team has spent the past several months examining what happens as people go into the state's prison system and what happens when they come out. Today, APR's Pat Duggins examines what happens to people who are convicted of crimes they didn't commit. It appears, not much.
If you had just been released after 3 years on Alabama's death row, what would be first on your to-do list?
Well, hug my kids and family and...
Randall Paget lives in Guntersville.
Touch a tree, touch some grass. I think a tree was the first thing. Well, no, I had to walk across the grass to get to the tree.
Paget was convicted for the murder of his estranged wife in 1990. He was exonerated 7 years later. As a free man, you might think Paget has every reason to be happy. He's not.
Lost my home and 32 acres of land, my job, and because probably between me and my family, probably spent $200,000 on attorneys.
All for something an Alabama jury says he didn't do.
Well, it's destroyed him.
That's attorney Richard Jaffe. He won Paget's freedom. In his law office in Birmingham, Jaffe has a lot to say about Alabama's policy on compensating people who were sent to prison for crimes they didn't commit. He's not a fan.
Well, Alabama's reparations law is completely impossible to... It might as well not exist.
We'll talk more about that in just a moment. First, here's how Paget wound up on death row to begin with. It started with a phone call.
I get on the phone, call my brother. I said, well, what happened? He said, all I know is there's a knife involved. So then I just got physically ill. I vomited twice, I think, and that's how I found out.
Paget's wife, Kathy, had been stabbed 46 times. Her body was found in their home in the town of Arab. They were separated at the time. Where Paget made his phone call didn't help matters. He was having an affair, and he was with the other woman. Prosecutors claimed Paget's DNA was found on the body at the crime scene. Attorney Richard Jaffe says there was just one problem with the state's case.
It was a huge blunder, for sure.
DNA taken from the crime scene was tested to establish blood type. The result was a match for Paget. Before the trial, the sample was tested again. The second result was a different blood type that didn't match Paget. He thought that alone would clear him.
Well, I'd seen stories about people getting convicted of something they didn't do. I guess I thought, well, that'll never happen to me. I don't know.
But it did. The jury found Paget guilty of murder. What's worse, the judge overruled the jury's recommendation of life in prison. Paget says his first night on death row let him know what he was in for.
About midnight, there was two guys talking up above me in adjoining cells, I presumed. It sounded like a white guy and a black guy. And so finally the black guy tells the other one, says, well, let's just sack out, you know, let's have a word of prayer. So he said this beautiful prayer. And I thought, man, this might not be such a bad place, you know. So the black guy, I guess, is trying to get him to end his prayer. And he says something about, let's have a moment of silence. And then the white guy, are you making fun of me, you black SOB? And then this starts cussing like a sailor after saying that beautiful prayer for so long. And I know where your mama lives, and I'm going to have her killed. And I know where your cousin lives, and I'm going to have her killed. And so then I said, this is a bad place.
The state never signed a death warrant for Paget, but four other men he knew at Atmore Prison weren't as lucky. Vernell Weeks was executed in 1995. Paget recalls how Weeks' final hours were marked by a death row tradition. A prison trustee made his way from cell to cell.
He was collecting up a bag full of goodies for Vernell, like have a party before, you know, candy, people throwing potato chips and candy in there. And I'm thinking, man, that guy don't want to have no party. You know, he knows they're going to kill him tonight.
Paget was set free 2 years later. Attorney Richard Jaffe.
I've never figured out whether it was a blunder, an accident, was it on purpose? Was it sneaky? I've scratched my head on that, and to this day, I have no idea what the reason for it was.
Jaffe's referring to the botched DNA evidence from Padgett's original trial. In 1995, the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals ruled the prosecution hid those DNA results from the defense. A new trial was ordered, and that jury found Padgett not guilty. Now, let's get back to his money problems.
Randall was doing pretty decently on the chicken farm, and he lost that.
Richard Jaffe.
He had legal fees to his original lawyers, the appeal or whatever. He had legal fees to us, and he lost the chicken farm, and he's never really gotten on his feet economically, financially.
In 2001, the Alabama legislature passed the Compensation for Wrongful Incarceration Act. Exonerees were supposed to get $50,000 for each year they spent in prison. Padgett applied in 2003. The state said no.
Not guilty is not innocent, according to the state of Alabama, which I don't understand what's the definition of guilty, you know. And if you're not guilty, are you not innocent?
Apparently not. A quick check of the Alabama Code leads to Section 29-2-161. That's the law to pay people for wrongful incarceration. It says the charges have to be dismissed because the defendant was totally innocent.
It's very hard to prove a negative.
Attorney Richard Jaffe is talking about providing absolute proof of innocence. He says it's tougher than it sounds.
I see one way that someone could take advantage of it, and that is if there was absolute 100% clear DNA and somebody was, say, in Alaska, and you could put those two facts together, and that the person could probably prevail under the law.
And for people like Padgett, the burden of proof falls on them. Also, it's unlikely that Richard Jaffe or any other attorney could help argue the case. The Wrongful Incarceration Act prevents any money from a state settlement to going to pay legal fees.
I'm doing well. I know.
Anyone who wants payment for wrongful jail time has to go to the state capitol in Montgomery. Alabama has a committee to hear claims, and Senate President Pro Tem Del Marsh is on that panel. He says it comes with the title.
I could put a designee on there. I could step away from this. But I do think it's something we have to look, give serious consideration to. And if something's, if somebody has been wronged, then we want to, as a state, to do all we can to make it right.
But along with this justice-for-all attitude, Marsh says the question of innocence always comes up.
The fact is they could be wrongly incarcerated in some cases, not because they were innocent, but because of a procedure.
And even if there's a legitimate claim, Marsh says there's another question to be asked before the state pulls out its checkbook.
Was there something that happened on the local level where the, I'm not, but it could be a case where the prosecutor maybe, for instance, didn't provide evidence they should have provided. You know, at what point is it more of a local responsibility than the state's responsibility?
And even if Marsh and his committee members say the state should pay, the legislature has to set aside the money, and it's not legally required to do that. So far, Alabama's track record on this speaks for itself. In the 15 years since the passage of the Wrongful Incarceration Act, only one case has resulted in payment. It wasn't Randall Padgett's.
I ain't asking for $1 million, but I'd like to be put back to where I was.
Padgett hopes his case doesn't end up like the one that did result in compensation. That defendant died a year before the claim was settled. The money went to his family. Pat Duggins, APR News, in Guntersville.
Alabama's prison system has been in the news a lot this year, and not for good reasons. Inmate riots, as well as allegations of mismanagement and corruption, have pointed out plenty of problems. The Alabama Public Radio News team has spent the past several months examining what happens as people go into the state's prison system and what happens when they come out. Today, APR's Mackenzie Bates hears from critics of how Alabama's prisons are run and how plans to fix things may just be throwing money at the problem.
You're going down in this, man. Look at this.
If you've never been inside Alabama's Atmore prison, don't worry. Back in March, Atmore came to you. This cell phone video was shot during riots at the prison. Inmates set fires, attacked guards and the warden. The violence was supposedly sparked by overcrowding. Rufus Ricks knows the problem firsthand.
At lights out, it would be quiet. People would be asleep. But now, it's not like that no more. It's always somebody awake and people always moving around because it's just so crowded.
Rick spent 20 years in an Alabama prison on robbery charges. He's been housed in several of Alabama's 14 prisons during his sentence, so he's seen a lot.
First, they have two-man cells, and they start putting an extra racking there. So now you got three people in this small area. And I got my property. He got his property. He got his property. They lock you down at night. You might need to use the bathroom, you know, and I mean, we're dealing with feces. The smells and all kind of stuff is terrible.
In 1979, Alabama's prisons had about 6,000 prisoners. Today, the Department of Corrections says the state has more than 28,000 people behind bars. Prisons designed to hold about 13,000 inmates are more than 100% over capacity. Take Limestone Correctional Facility, for example. The prison near the town of Harvest opened in 1984. It's supposed to hold just over 2,000 inmates.
We have 2,236 today, and we have 2,532 beds.
That's Christopher Gordy. He's the warden at Limestone.
Where did you come from?
Limestone is one of the largest prisons in the state, but when it comes to overcrowding, it does make it difficult for his officers to do their job.
You got beds, double bunk beds, stacked up sometimes less than 10 inches from each other. So it makes it very difficult for the officers to patrol the dorm, to be able to see everything that happened in the dormitory.
It's a hot day at Limestone. There's no air conditioning and it smells like it. Fans are used to try and cool the facility, but today it's not helping. There are so many prisoners gathered in one place, the temperature rises quickly.
We will become the best Department of Corrections in the country rather than the worst. I like to be number one, even if it's in the prison systems.
That's Governor Robert Bentley. He's pushing a plan to consolidate Alabama's 14 prisons into four mega prisons housing 4,000 inmates each. Bentley says by downsizing, the state would save millions of dollars.
You don't have 14 kitchens, you don't have 14 hospitals, it's efficiencies. Plus the fact that we're having to repair all these old prisons right now.
Prison overcrowding is the result of a lot of things, but policy is a main driver of it, not buildings.
Catherine Green Robertson is the vice president of the Alabama Policy Institute in Birmingham. She's a big critic of the state's plan, where the math doesn't seem to add up.
I think if you're going to sell the public on $1.5 billion bond issue, which is what it is once you add the interest, you better be sure that it's actually going to solve the problem, which there's no evidence that it will.
Brian Stevenson of the Equal Justice Initiative agrees with Robertson. He doesn't think new prisons are the answer.
It's like having a college football team that keeps losing every game, and your solution is, let's build a brand new stadium. That'll solve the problem. It won't. You need better coaching, and you need better players.
As far as we know, at this point, there was only the one injury with the inmate being stabbed by the other inmate. We are told sources...
Stevenson says the riots at Atmore Prison are just one indication of a system with big problems. But critics say that's not the only issue. Alabama's prison system reportedly spends less per prisoner per day than anywhere else in the nation. $26 daily to house and rehabilitate an Alabama inmate compared to close to $70 in other states. Brian Stevenson of the EJI says then there's the mismanagement.
So we have people serving life and life without parole for writing bad checks, for being in possession of marijuana, for shoplifting, for very minor crimes. That's the biggest problem. I actually think we could get 5,000-10,000 people out of our prisons next week without any threat to public safety.
Even Governor Bentley concedes that point.
Our system is a Department of Corrections, not a Department of Housing. So we need to try to correct them, help them become productive citizens. That's how we're going to save money, but we're going to save lives too.
Bentley's $800 million prison plan received a lukewarm response from state lawmakers. The proposal failed in the general session this year, and Bentley hopes to revive it next year. The Alabama Policy Institute says the plan needed more thought, and they're not the only ones.
And typical of Alabama government, we don't deal with situations until they're a crisis.
Chris England saw Bentley's plan. He sits on the House Judiciary Committee in Montgomery.
Unfortunately, when things reach crisis level, your remedy is often going to be somewhat ineffective and very expensive.
Opponents of the governor's prison plan say research and preparation are one key concern. And Brian Stevenson of the Equal Justice Initiative says these problems start at the top.
Our politicians here have been preaching fear and anger for a half century. And when you create a culture where everybody is competing with one another over who can be the toughest on crime, you start doing some pretty irrational things when it comes to sentencing.
One example is Alabama's Habitual Felony Offender Act. Defendants with prior convictions for things like writing bad checks or nonviolent theft can be sentenced to life in prison without parole for future crimes. The Equal Justice Initiative says 2,000 inmates in Alabama's prisons are serving life under this act. Brian Stevenson.
And when you take a situation like overcrowded prisons, under-motivated staff, some of whom are engaged in corruption and abusive practices, it's going to be a really, really bad system.
Catherine Green Robertson at the Alabama Policy Institute wants more answers about how and where they will save money and says so do the constituents of Alabama. The concern is that once the $800 million prison plan has been paid off, the final cost will balloon to $1.5 billion.
It sounds like there was a company that was sort of advising the administration, giving them some sort of ballpark numbers, and that in simplified terms, where the $800 million number came from. But I do think in a plan of this magnitude, given Alabama's very fragile fiscal condition, we still haven't seen enough data to show how that number was arrived at.
And so, Warden Christopher Gordy, his guards, and the inmates on his watch remain waiting. The plan would shut down several of the existing prisons, but a few would remain open. He is optimistic Limestone will stay open if the plan moves forward.
I may be a little prejudiced to say, but this is a very good operating facility. It is the largest in the state, and the structures of the building is pretty good. So if I, and I've been to the other facilities in the state, so if I have to be a betting man, we probably have a good chance of probably staying open.
There could be more at stake than whether or not Alabama can afford Bentley's plan. Prison overcrowding is an issue nationwide. California could be an example of Alabama's future if nothing is done. Prisons in the Golden State were at 200% capacity, just like here in Alabama. The situation was so bad, a federal judge declared California's prisons violated the Eighth Amendment ban on cruel and unusual punishment. That was followed by threats of a federal takeover. Some in Alabama are wondering how long it will be before this state attracts that type of attention from Washington. For APR News, I'm Mackenzie Bates.
Alabama's prison system has been in the news a lot this year, and not for good reasons. Inmate riots, allegations of mismanagement and corruption, and a failed prison building plan in the state legislature have pointed out plenty of problems. The Alabama Public Radio News team has spent the past several months examining what happens as people go into the state's prison system and what happens when they come out. Today, APR's Pat Duggins looks at ongoing complaints over how Alabama judges sentence people to death.
I just want what's right for my brother.
Jody Kirkland is from Andalusia. Her brother, Roy Doster, is on Alabama's death row.
Because he didn't kill that man. I don't know about the one in Texas, but Texas ain't trying to kill him.
Putting it lightly, the Alabama judicial system doesn't consider Roy Doster to be a Boy Scout. Both killings occurred after he broke out of jail in Covington County. That's why Doster's on death row.
It was complete misery. It's like being in a nightmare you can't wake up from.
If anybody knows what Roy Doster is going through, it's Randall Padgett of Guntersville. He spent 3 years on Alabama's death row. He remembers when he first arrived.
Well, I got down there at night. It was about 10:30 at night, and didn't have any light in my little cell, and I'm scared, And anyways, you hear all this commotion going on, screaming, and doors, metal doors sliding shut.
Padgett's case is different from Roy Doster's. Padgett's conviction was thrown out over how prosecutors handled DNA evidence. Doster, on the other hand, is still waiting to die for killing a Covington County man. However, in both cases, the sentence of death was handed down the same way, and Padgett says what his judge did confuses him to this day.
The jury recommends life without.
That's life in prison without parole.
Why in the world would he reverse that and give me the electric chair?
Bear in mind, Padgett was convicted in 1990. Alabama electrocuted people until 2002 when the state switched to lethal injection. Whether it's death by voltage or drugs, Jody Kirkland says it's not fair that her brother's jury recommended a life sentence and the judge said no.
I'm not saying that Roy should not pay for the crimes that he did commit, But being put to death is not justice.
Alabama is the only state in the nation with a statute allowing judges to overrule a jury's recommendation of life in prison in favor of a death sentence.
That is precisely the opposite of what the Supreme Court says is appropriate.
That's Evan Farber. He's an attorney representing Roy Doster as he appeals his death sentence. And that defense is taking shape a long way from Alabama. Farber is a partner at the law firm Reed Smith in New York City. And as for his relationship with Roy Doster...
He is my only death row inmate. He's my first death row client, actually, I should say. You know, I may have more over the course of my career.
Even if Doster's case is a first for Evan Farber, it's not for Reed Smith. Most of that law firm's pro bono work centers on judicial overrides. Farber says Alabama's statute is not only unconstitutional, it's not right.
You know, particularly in a case like Roy Doster's, where the jury voted 12-0 for a life sentence, and then one person comes in and says, well, I disagree, I'm going to impose death. That seems incredibly unfair.
Really, in no area of criminal law do juries impose sentences.
Andrew Brasher is Alabama's Solicitor General. That means he argues on behalf of the state, and he's more than ready to go to bat on the subject of judicial overrides.
What juries do is they adjudicate guilt and innocence. Those adjudications then, under the statutes, work to provide a range of sentencing options that then a judge chooses among those ranges.
At least that appeared to be the case until this happened back in January.
The U.S. Supreme Court has found that Florida's death penalty sentencing system is unconstitutional. CBS 4's Natalia Zayas.
Florida used to allow judicial overrides, but not anymore. That's due to a U.S. Supreme Court decision in the murder case involving Timothy Lee Hurst. In Hurst versus Florida, the judge and the jury both agreed the defendant deserved death. However, the judge considered evidence the jury didn't see before making up his mind on a sentence. The justices said that was wrong. For attorney Evan Farber in the case of Roy Doster in Alabama, that Supreme Court decision is a legal aha moment. Sort of.
Now, that's not saying that they believe that Alabama is equivalent to Florida, but that's pretty strongly implying it. So that's what gives me some hope. And you know, if you read the Florida decision itself, it's written broadly enough that it seems like it ought to apply, and in my view, certainly does apply to Alabama as well.
I mean, our position, which was adopted by the Court of Criminal Appeals, is that Hurst really adds nothing.
Alabama Solicitor General Andrew Brasher says the Hurst versus Florida case actually proves Alabama's override statute is constitutional. That's because of how jurors find defendants guilty under Alabama law.
There has to be some aggravating factor or aggravating circumstance on top of your murder. And the jury has to find that. They have to find it either at the guilt phase when they're adjudicating guilt or innocence, or they have to find it at the sentencing phase.
By an aggravating factor, Brasher means the murder needs to be really bad, like killing someone during a sexual assault or murdering more than one person during a crime. In Roy Doster's case, prosecutors argue he was an escaped prisoner when he killed a Covington County man. Brasher argues that gave the judge the power to override the jury. Defense attorney Evan Farber rejects that.
In our view, the ideal situation is that, as with every other crime, and as the Supreme Court has found is a requirement of a criminal sentence, the jury should be charged with finding all of the elements and with deciding that he is sentenced to death.
I mean, Alabama is full of sinful hypocrites. And that's what this state's all about.
While the arguments drag on, Jody Kirkland's frustration is clear. Time appears to be running out for her brother.
And, you know, it's easy to judge somebody that you don't know. And if you don't know their heart and the love that it holds, you do not know that person.
Kirkland also says her brother has stopped talking to her during visits on death row. He says the less she knows, the better. Pat Duggins, APR News. In Andalusia.
Alabama's prison system has been in the news a lot this year, and not for good reasons. Violence, inmate riots, allegations of mismanagement and corruption, and a failed prison building plan in the state legislature have all pointed out plenty of problems. The Alabama Public Radio News team has spent the past several months examining what happens as people go into the state's prison system and what happens when they come out. Today, APR's Alex Aubuchon looks at the quality of prison health care in Alabama and examines a federal lawsuit challenging whether inmates receive the minimum care guaranteed in the Constitution.
It hurts. He was my best friend.
Erica Fikes is talking about her father, Philip Anderson. She's his youngest daughter. Anderson was arrested in Tuscaloosa in early February last year. Prosecutors say he missed a child support hearing. A week later, he was dead.
We went down thinking that he was fine because the chief told us that he was fine.
That's Kimberly Coates, Anderson's sister.
And we went to the hospital, and that's when the doctors told us that he had passed away.
Coates says jail officials didn't call her to say there was any trouble. Anderson's fellow inmates saw him unconscious, took his cell phone, and called the family.
His screams were not only ignored and rejected, he was belittled. He was called a faker and a malingerer.
Attorney David Schoen is representing the Anderson family in a lawsuit. He alleges the staff at the Tuscaloosa County Jail sat and watched as Anderson screamed in pain from a bleeding ulcer. When he finally received medical attention, it was too late. Anderson is not alone in Alabama.
Guys have died in lockup, beating on their door. Seriously.
Abdullah Mumin now lives in Tuscaloosa. He spent 28 years in Alabama prisons across the state.
You're trying to get this guy's attention in this cubicle and get him to see what's up. And they up in there laughing or playing on their phone, and you die in your cell because this guard didn't want to open your door.
The Southern Poverty Law Center and the Alabama Disabilities Advocacy Program are among the groups suing the Alabama Department of Corrections over inmate health care.
Prisoners are dying. Prisoners with serious mental health problems are killing themselves.
Richard Cohen of the SPLC says he wants specific things from the lawsuit.
First, ensure that people who are behind bars get a basic level of care as the Supreme Court says that they must. Secondly, we hope that our lawsuit encourages the state to continue to reduce its unconscionably high levels of incarceration.
We have a requirement, and it's one that we take very, very seriously, to address and meet the medical needs of our inmates.
Jefferson Dunn is the commissioner of the Alabama Department of Corrections. He agrees that overcrowding is a major issue when it comes to providing medical care. But Dunn says he thinks the care they provide is adequate.
We handle the entire gamut that you can imagine, from very routine all the way up to some of the most serious medical trauma, emergency, this particular population as a group tends not to be as healthy as an average population that's not within the system. And so, yes, I do think they are receiving adequate medical care.
Alongside the lawsuit, the Southern Poverty Law Center released a report in June of 2014 called Cruel Confinement. It details their investigation into the medical and mental health offerings in Alabama's state prisons. Maria Morris is the lead prosecutor on the case for the SPLC. She says one of the most striking things from that report was the way the Alabama Department of Corrections has handled infectious disease outbreaks.
There is no one responsible for infection control in most facilities. And one of the things we see as a result is an extraordinarily high level of tuberculosis.
Morris says one tuberculosis outbreak lasted for 5 years.
They had an outbreak of tuberculosis in 2010, and you can track strains of tuberculosis. And the outbreak that occurred in 2010 at Donaldson was still going on at different prisons in 2015, which means that they were unable to eradicate that particular outbreak of tuberculosis. And that's an extraordinarily long time for any outbreak to last in a prison system.
Morris is referring to the Donaldson Correctional Facility, just west of Birmingham. Caring for mentally ill inmates is another key element of the lawsuit and another sore spot in Alabama's prisons. ADOC Commissioner Dunn says it's a major priority.
We have a very strong focus on mental health care. We have an entire staff of mental health professionals, from counselors all the way up to psychiatrists. We do residential treatment in a couple of our facilities.
Because there are so few mental health professionals on staff with the Department of Corrections, the caseloads get overwhelming. And Morris says it's the patients that suffer.
Some of them have caseloads of over 200 people. As a result, the counseling that they provide is really much more of a check-in. It's, 5 or 10 minutes a month for people who have schizophrenia, saying, how are you doing? Are you doing okay on your meds? Everything good? Okay.
But former prisoner Abdullah Mumin says you might not even get that.
They're in lockup. So that means that for them to see the psychiatrist, they got to have an appointment scheduled. So they're going to handcuff and shack you and take you up here to the front office to have a sit down and talk. But sometimes they don't even do that. They're lying.
Then this happened.
Live from WIAT 42 News with coverage you can count on.
A federal judge grants class action status to a lawsuit filed by Alabama inmates. They claim the state isn't providing adequate mental health treatments.
U.S. District Judge Myron Thompson granted class action status to the mental health portion of the lawsuit. Thompson says mental health professionals told the Department of Corrections they needed more staff, but the DOC refused to pay for it. Judge Thompson says that constitutes deliberate indifference. When asked to comment directly on the case, DOC Commissioner Dunn declined.
The judicial process needs to work itself out, and we just want to be as respectful of that process as we can as we work out these issues. Yeah.
It's unclear how Judge Thompson will rule in terms of health and mental health care in Alabama's prisons. One thing's for sure, though. If you find yourself in the custody of the Alabama Department of Corrections, it might be a good idea not to get sick. I'm Alex Aubuchon, Alabama Public Radio News. The Alabama Public Radio News team has been looking at the condition of Alabama's prisons. The system has been in the news a lot this year, and not for good reasons. Inmate riots, allegations of mismanagement and corruption, and a failed prison building plan in the state legislature have pointed out plenty of problems. APR's Stan Ingold reports on what happens when prisoners in Alabama try to re-enter society.
This is the first thing prisoners hear when they enter the Alabama prison system. It's also the last thing when they come out.
They give you a bus ticket and a check for $10, and they say, have a nice life.
That's Brenda Lee Kennedy. She was incarcerated in the Montgomery Work Release Center for nearly 5.5 years before being released in November of last year.
They put you out of the gate, they take you to the bus station, and you're free. You are thrust back into society with absolutely nothing.
It's a common complaint among ex-convicts. After what could be decades behind bars, inmates are dumped back into society essentially on their own. Critics call it the second sentence.
You typically lose your driver's license when you go to prison. When you come out of prison, you have to report to your probation officer.
Joyce White Vance is the U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Alabama.
You're certainly going to be trying to find a new job. At some point, you're probably going to get behind the wheel of a car without a driver's license. You're probably going to get pulled over. You're probably going to get rearrested. That's a reentry fail.
Why should Alabama care? Vance says if ex-cons aren't working a job, they're likely to be doing something else.
People come out of prison, they commit new crimes, they go back to prison. The goal is for people to come out of prison and not commit more crimes, for people to go back and become hardworking, tax-paying members of the community who are engaged with their family. And the question is, why doesn't that happen?
Again, why should Alabama care? Vance says because a lot of Alabamians have done jail time.
The numbers that come out of the Alabama Department of Corrections say that 1 in 4 adults in Alabama has had either a felony or a misdemeanor conviction.
That's a lot of job application forms with a little checkbox that asks if you've been convicted. Many businesses shy away from hiring people who check that box with a yes. Vance's office is unusual because it's the first in the nation to hire an attorney specifically to get inmates back into the workforce when they get out of prison.
This is our youth department. This is where the juvenile justice program is here.
The private sector is trying to help too. That's where the Dannon Project comes in.
What my husband's family and I wanted to do was to start an agency that provided a prescription, if you will, to provide support for people when they come home.
Carrie Pruitt founded the Birmingham-based group to help former prisoners find jobs. A personal tragedy got her going. Pruitt's brother-in-law, Dannon, was killed by someone recently released from prison. She and her husband started the Dannon Project to systematically prepare inmates to re-enter society.
Your case managers still stay in contact with you weekly or biweekly. We have retention specialists that stay engaged. We have mentors that stay engaged.
That work also includes things like getting a proper ID and a social security card.
I had nothing, no card, no nothing, no family here, no nothing.
That's Fletcher Strong. He went through the program at the Denham Project and is still seeing the benefits.
I'm still on that same job, and now I'm a supervisor. I'm in school, taking college courses. See, I made it to the seventh grade, got my GED, and now I'm in college.
Kerry Pruitt says the Denham Project doesn't wait for people to come to them. The group goes into prisons as well to work alongside reentry efforts of the state.
Supervising you then, all right, what happened to SRP? So you don't have to worry about SRP now.
These are the reentry courses going on at Limestone Correctional Facility. The inmates are within 6 months of their EOS or end of sentence. Mary Weston is the pre-release program supervisor at Limestone. She says there are a number of courses the inmates are required to take part of as part of their reentry process.
So it's family reintegration, anger management, substance abuse, along those lines. Everything that's like a criminogenic behaviors or needs is what we focus on in the core curriculum.
If you're checking yourself, there's a system that's like what they call a soft core, so that won't hurt you.
The Limestone facility has room for 300 inmates who are EOSing, and the reentry program here often takes on prisoners from other sites across the state. Weston says some of the ones who have the hardest time transitioning are the people who have been locked up for a long time.
You know, the world's moved on. Things have changed, and so it tries to help them prepare from a cognitive behavioral standpoint, where they can help process information better, make better decisions, make better choices. I mean, the goal here is to reduce recidivism rates, to help them stay out and be productive members of society, and to reintegrate successfully back with their families.
Weston says it's ultimately up to the person whether or not they succeed upon release.
I went back to school and got my associate's degree, bachelor's degree, my law degree. I'm licensed to practice law in Minnesota and North Carolina.
Daryl Atkinson is taking up that challenge. He was sentenced to 10 years for a nonviolent first offense drug crime. He served just over 3 years before he was released.
I highlight those particular ticks on the resume not to illustrate any exceptional attributes that I have. I'm pretty average. I left 100 brilliant men behind the wall.
Despite all the effort, Alabama still has a recidivism rate of almost 30%. So for just about every Daryl Atkinson, there's another person who breaks the law again, costing the state more tax dollars as they're arrested, tried, convicted, and sent to prison. For APR News, I'm Stan Ingold at the Limestone Correctional Facility.